I can't say I'm much into what it all means, just that it means something. That we were all born under a different moon and a different sign, and I believe in it, I think. And besides, Robert Hayden loved the moon.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Lauren Korn. Talking with Hanif Abdurraqib, whose latest book, A Little Devil in America, Notes in Praise of Black Performance, is part memoir, part cultural study, and one that celebrates Black performers, Black artistry, Black futures, and the performance of Blackness in America. Hanif is a poet, essayist, and cultural critic from Columbus, Ohio. He is the author of the poetry collections The Crown Ain't Worth Much and A Fortune for Your Disaster. Hanif, welcome to The Right Question.
Thanks for having me, Lauren. It's great to be here.
So I guess we're just going to jump in. Can you explain your book's title, A Little Devil in America, to our listeners?
Yeah, the title comes from Josephine Baker's speech at the March on Washington in 1963, which is a speech that I think a lot of people don't know exists because, you know, Josephine Baker's presence at the March on Washington is kind of buried underneath all the other parts of history, its history that has been kind of sanitized and repackaged. But Josephine Baker gave a speech at the March on Washington when she was a much older woman than I think a lot of the public had come to know her as, when she was kind of on the tail end of her career on stage a bit. And the speech is biting and smart and witty and funny at times, you know, because she realized she was speaking to a much younger audience or largely a younger audience. There's a point in it where she says, go home and ask your parents about me and they'll tell you I was a devil. I was a devil in other countries and I was a little devil in America too.
I was hoping you might read an excerpt, maybe reading the first couple paragraphs of Nine Considerations of Black People in Space, and then the last couple paragraphs. I felt that would be a good chapter to kind of dive into too.
Nine Considerations of Black People in Space is kind of a somewhat scattered but hopefully kind of connected thread of vignettes about Black people in the future or considering the future or asking myself questions about the future's capability to hold a really fluorescent and wide-ranging Blackness. You know, I wanted to kind of cover as much ground as possible and allow myself to be as, you know, to kind of be tonally fluid. And so, yeah, I'll read the first couple paragraphs of the first section and then the last paragraph of the last section. To be fair, I cannot claim that I love the moon as much as all my pals and ancestors and peers. I maybe do not love the moon as much as other poets who seem to love the moon for what it is capable of doing to the waters or how it seduces the best or worst out of an astrological sign. I don't know much about astrology, but I do like the idea of astrology for what it brings out in my most creative and magically inclined friends. Alyssa, leaning eagerly over a table to ask me if I know the exact hour and minute of my birth, so that we might do my natal chart and finally get down to the issue of what's going on with all my emotional rattling about. Madison, scrolling furiously through her phone over a dinner to see what phase the moon is in or what planets are twirling ever more maniacally out of whack so that she might explain to me why all the furniture in my heart's most precious corners has been overturned. Still, I can't say I'm much into what it all means, just that it means something. That we were all born under a different moon and a different sign, and I believe in it, I think. I have taken to waving a dismissive hand and telling a friend, that's such a Virgo thing to say, even when I'm not entirely sure what I mean. And no one has corrected me yet, so either I'm right, or I have surrounded myself with immensely kind people, which is probably a very Scorpio thing to say. And besides, Robert Hayden loved the moon. And what a fool I would be to not love what Robert Hayden loved, to not drink from whatever his palms offered. Robert Hayden so loved the moon that he decided to strip it of its magic entirely, so it was just a hanging and cratered glowing rock tasked with dividing up the darkness. And I, too, dig the moon most when it is a question of its functions. How, for example, I might have once slid underneath it in some alley on a clear night to better see the face of a dear brother or to skim a phone number scrawled onto a napkin after spilling out of some dive. I wish to view the moon as Hayden viewed the moon, an object that has a purpose rooted primarily in how it shines and little else. In the end, this is a bit about Sun Ra and the potential for a future that is generous to the people I love. When this planet begins to drown itself and becomes unlivable, I might not be alive anymore. Some people might go to Mars, but I don't think many of my people will go there. My friend, who has a flag that reads, "There are black people in the future," hanging above her bed, plays a new Janelle Monáe album for me in her car on a nighttime drive through a city neither of us know well. And when Screwed comes on, she puts a hand on my shoulder, wide-eyed, and tells me this is what our past will sound like in the future. And I do think that is true, though it assumes we'll all be living, and I don't want to get my hopes up. But still, there is a reason for this reckless and gasping pursuit of a world beyond this world. I am interested in what it feels like to imagine yourself as large and immovable as the sky. I have tried to love the unreliable moon through its shifting and through the clouds coughing their way over it. That hasn't worked for me. So I don't want to go to the moon, but I do want to go to the place where black dreamers stare at the moon and remark loudly about signs and stars in a summer that feels as endless as those old summers which pulled me from the paltry responsibilities of youth. The planet within the planet. People dance in spacesuits, and young black boys fire rockets above the trees, and they always come back down in one piece. And sure, we'll crack some malt liquor for the drinking folks, I guess. For as long as there is a future, there will be black people in it, hopefully surviving in even newer and better ways than we are now. Circles of light opening their arms wide to briefly take our bodies somewhere higher. It will appear spectacular to everyone who isn't us.
That was beautiful. Thank you. You said prior to reading that excerpt or from that segment that, you know, you took a lot of pieces and kind of brought them together. And how did you begin this book, and how did all of these topics find a resting place together?
Well, I think the real generosity of this book was that I was asking myself primarily, you know, I was kind of the architect of the book's central curiosity, which was I could define performance in any way I wanted to. And then the writing, the work of the writing, was to convince people that the performance that I was curious about or orbiting was not only worthwhile, but that it was something that, you know, registers under the umbrella of performance, even if it's something that people did not normally think of as a performance. And so with that, it opened up a real opportunity for me to connect things that I otherwise maybe would not have found my way to. And with that also, it provided an opportunity, I think, for me to play around with this idea of the magic that happens when I would realize that something I had seen as common because my life was so immersed in it was actually uncommon and really spectacular. You know, when I approach writing with a sense of wonder and a sense of the magical and the spectacular, it kind of makes it easy to make these connections, because it's understanding that so much of what I am witness to and party to is otherworldly and unexplainable. And so I detach myself from the desire to explain and instead attach myself to a desire to broaden an understanding that comes through kind of attaching as many hooks to it as I can.
When you decided to write this book, or when you decided that these pieces were going to be a cohesive whole, who were you writing to? Who was your imagined audience?
You know, it's funny that Spade's piece was excerpted in the New York Times Magazine, which I'm very grateful for. And in the editing process, you know, I worked with a black editor, but of course there's a bunch of editors there. And one of the white editors was like, "Well, do you think he can explain Spade's a little bit for people who have never played?" He's like, "Well, no, because that defeats the piece." In the piece, I actually explicitly say I'm not going to explain the game, right? And so the audience I'm writing towards, in a way, people who don't need Spades explained to them. And I say that to say that, like, that doesn't even entail Spades players, but it perhaps entails people who have watched the game be played and have understood it through that. But that's like a funnier way of saying that, you know, my audience was very insular. It was people I love and people I know who I love a great deal. And I understand that in writing this book, it will be consumed by many people. Which is why I don't get concerned. I don't get too bogged down with the question of audience, because, like, no matter what my intent is, I lose a level of autonomy over that intent once the book enters the world. Yes, I had intent when I set out to write this, but it almost feels unimportant or underimportant when I deal with the reality of the fact that on March 30th or whenever, you know, when the book comes out, I no longer have control over those intentions. And I don't even have control over the way that people I intended a book for read the book on their own. And so I really have to divest myself from this kind of idea of loyalty to my imagined audiences, even though I do imagine audiences.
So this is not obviously your first book. And so as a published writer, you have had a lot of practice at kind of that divestment from that audience and kind of disattaching yourself from intent, like you said. But as a person who is writing about really important things to you and people important to you, how do you navigate that? What do you feel having these experiences and feelings out in the world?
Well, I think I've found a good balance of keeping things, some things for myself, right? Whenever people ask me for advice for young writers, they always want to talk about like quote unquote publishing advice or that kind of thing. When really I think what I needed more was like emotional advice coming up, you know, someone who like did not care about publishing for a long time. And I needed to hear that it's important to keep some things to yourself and for yourself. Because if you are going to embark on a journey that invites people into your personal history, it is important to say, well, yes, I'm still the conductor of my own history. And I'm still the conductor of the way that history appears to the public, you know, to the world outside of myself. That's real vital. And so a big way I cope with that is by understanding that, you know, there's stuff I keep to myself entirely that not everyone has access to. And that is how I feel most comfortable. You know, I came up in Poetry Slam, and that's kind of where my roots are. And I'm still, you know, if I'm being real, like I'm so thankful for those roots, because I think some of the lessons that have endured for me, the big capital W writing lessons that I've endured are, I would say, like 90% from that arena. And so it was someone in that arena of Poetry Slam when I was coming up who gave me that advice. And it feels, you know, it's something I still believe in is really vital.
Death and funerals, memorial services, what you write as homegoings, are all very present in A Little Devil in America and in Go Ahead in the Rain as well. Outside of how these topics are explored in this book, how do you daily think about death?
Anytime that I get someone who has enhanced my life or made my life a little bit better, I grieve their loss greatly, but I also have to meet their loss with a little bit of gratitude. This morning I was listening to Songs of the Key of Life, the Stevie Wonder record, and I had a moment where it's like, gosh, you know, like it is going to be awful for me when we lose Stevie. You know, I'm going to be really, really emotionally dislocating for me in the way it was when we lost like Aretha and all of these. But then I thought, but man, isn't it amazing that my life intersected with a life capable of this much greatness, you know? If I step really far back, our time here is not long and is not guaranteed for whatever it is we got. You know, I could have been someone alive in an era before Stevie Wonder made music. And so to think about the intersection of lives as little miracles, yes, that does bring on grief for me, but it also brings on gratitude. Because none of us are promised or guaranteed love or a group of people who will feel affection for us. You know, I think that I had an evolution on this when I was working on A Fortune for Your Disaster, when trying to write a book about heartbreak that wasn't vengeful. You know, so many men, when they write quote unquote heartbreak art, it's like angry and it's punishing. And instead of saying to myself, well, what a miracle that someone chose to love me for a little while, because that's not a promise, that's not guaranteed. And to strip myself of that entitlement too, of thinking that my time here is guaranteed and that I am guaranteed pleasure while I'm here, or people who improve and enliven my living while I'm here. I'm not guaranteed those things. And so I think I've become to look at all loss with a little bit of gratitude as well. And that helps me, I think about grief as a celebratory action and not just a painful action.
The death of your mother is also present in this book as well. You write at one point, I guess I have tricked you into reading about my mother again. I loved that moment. But you do talk about her death and your grief. What did your mother teach you about Blackness? And is there any part of that understanding that was lost when she died?
I don't think any part of the understanding was lost. I mean, briefly abandoned, sure. But I think because largely what my mother taught me was about softness and a gentleness with the world. You know, my mother was also someone who struggled with mental health, and to allow oneself a fullness that can best be and should best be accessed and celebrated by the people you love, because the rest of the world might not be able to or might not have the tools to, and to not spend time creating the tools for people to understand how to love you best, but to go to where people already have those tools. I mean, of course, you know, I abandoned some of those principles, I think, in my teenage years, and still have days where I abandon them, but I try to return to them as often as I can.
Each part or movement of your book begins with a sort of lyric section or an essay, a number of sentences separated by ampersands that read sort of like run-ons with a really wonderful energy and momentum. But I'm wondering how these lyrics came to begin these movements. How did they find their place in the book?
Those are the things I wrote first, I think. I mean, the book took a different shape. I will say the book began as one book, and then much like my last book of poems, I kind of threw away about half of it and became another book. And when I was approaching it becoming another book, a way I kind of got myself into the mode of writing that other book was by writing these like funhouse mirror versions of my histories, which, like, as we do in poems, right? Where it's like, this is something that mostly happened that I'm going to put a little something extra on, or that I'm going to extend or expand or make a little funnier, or I'm going to enliven this memory with a little extra seasoning. You know, in the book, there's ways that I don't think I contradict myself, but I try to complicate myself. And those really allowed me opportunities to do that, I think, really thoughtfully. You know, I think especially about the one at the end. I haven't read the book in a while, so maybe at the end where at the Memphis barbecue with the elders who are happy about Obama, right? And it made me think about how the way I present myself and the way I behave, not just like in my organizing circles, but also, you know, on the internet when talking about the nature of American empire, but I'm not going to bring that to a table of Black elders who are just happy in a moment. You know, there's a way that silence in the face of people you have a reverence for is a type of generosity, you know? And so thinking about those pieces as ways to also complicate myself while kind of having fun with manipulations of my own history. You know, I wrote like 15, 20 of those to get kind of back into the vibe of what I wanted the book to become.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Hanif Abdurraqib, author of A Little Devil in America, Notes in Praise of Black Performance. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Michael Jackson is all over this book, and I'm wondering whether his inclusion was fraught for you, or if exclusion was ever a consideration.
I think him and Mike Tyson were both really hard for me, although less Mike Tyson, because I don't really think I praise either of them as much as I praise, at least in Jackson's case, what his death allowed for, right? But yeah, I don't listen to Michael Jackson, and I haven't in years, and I've kind of like divested from Michael Jackson. But it is true that when he died, his death afforded me a type of pleasure that is almost, and this sounds cold, but it is almost separate from him as an artist or person. What I was trying to praise was mostly the gathering, the idea of gathering, or the idea of closeness that this death afforded me and my people. But I also didn't want to go overboard. Like, I didn't want to be like, Michael Jackson, greatest artist of all time, am I right? It was very much like, in 2009, this thing happened, or you need to understand that, like, this is how he played into my history. But that history has evolved. And just because I'm not like ashamed of the way he's played into my history in the past doesn't mean that I have not evolved beyond it. Mike Tyson was a little less fraught, because I think that part of the process of writing Mike Tyson into the book was writing his abuses into the book, or at least the way that he projected fear onto other people extended beyond the boxing ring, so that was a little less fraught. But Michael Jackson, yeah, I know he's like mentioned in a few, I think maybe two essays, maybe three, most prominently in Space one. But I think there's like a paragraph about him in a couple other places.
Yeah, little mentions here and there.
Yeah.
Do you stop listening to, do you stop reading, do you stop participating in a certain art or a performance? Do you separate the art from the artist, the idea from the person?
I do. I mean, this idea for me of divestment, particularly from pop culture, is a very personal decision. And I think what often happens is people sometimes wield that personal decision as a tool of self-righteousness. And that's where a lot of this stuff kind of spirals. And so for me, I am not really all that interested. Like, personally, do I think that I don't see how anyone can listen to R. Kelly, for example? Yeah, like, I don't see how anyone can listen to R. Kelly. But I also know that I am not going to stop every person in the world from listening to R. Kelly, right? But I came to that decision on my own. And that doesn't mean that it's a private thing, but that also means that I am very aware that the things I abstain from do not alone make me a righteous person, you know? And I don't want to wield them as if they do. And sometimes the things I abstain from, now this isn't the case with Michael Jackson or R. Kelly, but there have been times where I've had to abstain from a band or a film or whatever, where it's been like, I am doing this because I believe, like, I can no longer go further engaging with this art due to whatever moral setup I have. But it's not easy or fun or something I'm patting myself on the back for. Sometimes it's like, this is rough. And also, I think when people talk about separating art from artists, at least when I find myself going down that road, the question I'm actually asking myself is, can I detangle my personal life and my personal history from my engagement with this person's art? And so it's not separating art from artists for me as much as it is the question of, like, how do I detangle myself from, and I know when I'm asking that question, then I've already gone a bridge too far. Because what's real is, much like the way Michael Jackson appears in Little Devil, if there are memories that have been really illuminated by being adjacent to an artist, I'm not required to lose those, and I'm not required to feel shame about those. And I think that's important too, is that to divest from something in pop culture for me doesn't mean I have to uproot my entire history. It now sometimes means I don't celebrate that history loudly or what have you. But, like, I think the most prominent way Michael Jackson appears in Little Devil for me is understanding that, and again, I know this sounds cold when laid out like this, but his death afforded an opportunity for a type of pleasure that I think transcended him.
You know, when you are thinking about this conversation, it's not the art that you're actually divesting yourself from, or that's not usually what people mean when they are saying, how can I stop listening to this? It is, how can I now confront or think about these things that I have been through now that I know this artist has done this or has been this?
How do I reckon with the way this artist has enmeshed themselves in my life? Because so much of the experience for me is loving an artist to the point where I feel like I am immersed in their world. And then when I find out that world is a little more treacherous than I have the ability to live in, how do I make an exit that feels somewhat comfortable? And there are some times where I can just be like, you know, I hit a point and I'm like, no thanks. R. Kelly was years and years and years ago, and Michael Jackson for me was like shortly after he passed. And there are sometimes artists where I'm like, this is challenging, but worthwhile, and I need to kind of treat this as I would any other kind of severing, where it's like a slow process, not like weaning myself off the music, but allowing myself to say, I felt really good listening to this song, and I'm not going to listen to this song again. And that's okay. Getting to the point where I say, and that's okay.
So I've heard you talk about The Prestige during a couple of online events over the past year, and I was so pleasantly surprised to see how you were able to incorporate the film into A Little Devil in America. What is it about The Prestige that has grabbed a hold of you and won't let go? What freedoms does its narrative and its idea afford you as you continue to write about it?
I always talk about kind of holdover obsessions or leftover obsessions. And I thought I was done with The Prestige kind of as an obsession when I finished Fortune. But as I was working on this book, it still cropped up, this idea of disappearing and reappearing and being perceived differently upon one's reappearing. It was kind of like, oh, this is maybe, I'm aching to talk about this too. But the idea of magic in the magic trick sticks with me always, and it stuck with me since I started writing Fortune in 2016. And there's something about The Prestige too that I'm invested in, and it's this idea of our multiple selves allowing us to live multiple complex lives. And so, I'm obsessed with the movie. I'm less obsessed with the book, but I do like the book. They're pretty different, but I really have a lot of love for The Prestige. When working on Fortune, I watched it like 25 times, and I haven't watched it since. And granted, like, this isn't all, you know, I worked on Fortune over the course of like years. But I love it a great deal.
Hanif, what are you optimistic about right now?
Very plainly, I'm optimistic about spring, which I know is like simple. The February we had here, I don't know what it was like there, but the February we had here was rough. I mean, it snowed what felt like every other day. And that happening at the tail end of a winter, like the winter we had, was just really hard because I was already, like a lot of people, just not going outside a lot. And then in February, going outside was like unbearable, out of the question entirely. And so the fact that the past 3 days it has been 60 and mostly sunny, I hope it stays sunny. I was planning to take a walk after this, but it's been like mostly sunny. It's been so incredible for me. And I am not actually someone who loves spring a lot, because in the Midwest, it just kind of means a lot of rain. But I think I'm optimistic about that temperamental nature returning to us here, because I've missed it. And, you know, as we descend on a year of the pandemic, I have especially needed that kind of feeling of the outdoors embracing me again.
What books are you reading right now? And because you are you, I want to expand that question to music too. Who are you listening to right now?
Yeah, so I dropped this book that's on my desk always. It's Marianne Chan's All Heathens, which is one of my favorite poetry books. I keep it on my desk, and it has a poem called In Defense of Karaoke, which is one of my favorite poems I've read in such a long time. Taylor Johnson's book, Inheritance. That's a brilliant book of poems I love a great deal. Honoré Jeffers, The Age of Phyllis, which is just like a monument. It's like I've never seen and experienced a poetry book like that, except for maybe Olio, you know, by Tahim Bijess, which is like, Age of Phyllis is like historical and thoughtful and immense. It's a lot to get through. But when I got through it, I was like, this book changed my life, like actually changed my life. You know, I've been reading a lot of zines and a lot of chapbooks. I'm a big chapbook person. I'm a big zine person still, you know. What am I listening to? I love the Sydney Sprague album, Maybe I Will See You at the End of the World. It is like delightfully apocalyptic. I love the new Regional Justice Center album, which is like, it's so funny. The other day I put it on, and I know Regional Justice Center. I know they're kind of like, this whole thing is like short, fast, and loud. But even with that in mind, I was like, I'm going to put this album on. It'll get me through my run. The album is like 16 minutes long or 13 minutes long or something. Wow. The Adult Mom album has really done it for me. Oh, the new Tiger's Jaw album is really beautiful. Adrian Young's album. Mavi has a great EP that came out last week that I love too.
Hanif, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me, Lauren. It was a real pleasure to talk.
Look for more information about Hanif at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Peter Hoag and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our recording engineer is Beth Ann Austin. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.